the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host.
Good morning. This is Paul Horn filling in for Jim Poplava on Lifetime Income this week. Jim is out on vacation getting some much deserved rest. This week, we'll be talking about wealth transfer. Unfortunately, most families that build wealth fail to pass it on to subsequent generations. In fact, 70% of the time, the wealth doesn't even get past the first generation. To quote Nathan Rothschild, it requires a great deal of boldness and caution to make a great fortune, and when you got it, it requires 10 times as much wit to keep it. I'm very excited for today's podcast as we have on a great guest, Mitzi Perdue, who has unique insights into how families can build and sustain their wealth over generations, as she has herself has experienced this with not once, but twice. So Mitzi, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you've become a recognized leader in talking about families managing and maintaining their wealth?
Oh, I'd like nothing better. My expertise in this comes because I come from two business families that are very, very long-lived. The first one, my father was the co-founder of the Sheraton Hotels, but the company didn't begin with my father. It began in 1840 with the Henderson Estate Company. We just celebrated our 128th annual reunion. So we are a very, very long-lived family. And my family by marriage is the Perdue Chicken Company, and we're about to celebrate our 100th anniversary in 2020. And I've made a lifetime study of why is it that some families make it across the generations, like my two families have, and why do some crash and burn? And that's what I've spent as much time as I possibly can interviewing people, taking courses, reading books, but most of all, observing what the successful families do. The biggest observation I have after really a lifetime of looking at this issue is that every single family that exists, whether it's a business family or not, it has a culture. And by culture, I mean the way we do things. It's kind of the habits and the attitudes and the ways of looking at the world. But the biggest question, to my mind, between the families that make it and the families that don't is, do they leave their culture to chance? Or do they put a lot of effort into teaching the value? And in the case of both the families that I'm associated with, I think you'd hardly believe the amount of effort that we put into teaching kids just from the first age some of the things that they'll need to know if the family's going to continue. And some of these, like maybe one of the biggest ones, is you can't always be right. You can't always get your way, that you have to compromise.
Given that your families have been successful, what are some key lessons that our listeners can teach their heirs?
Well, again, if the goal is to last across the generations, develop a culture in which kids just from the youngest age know that they're part of something bigger than themselves and that they have a responsibility to give to it as well as take back. And I'll share with you how we do that in both families that I'm associated with. One of the things that we do, just to make sure that the kids absorb the culture that we want rather than leaving it to accident, rather than leaving their attitudes and their approach to life. I don't want it to come from popular culture. I don't want it to come from their teenage peers. I don't want it to come from the mass media. I want it to come from the family. And one of the ways that we do this is in the Henderson family, back in 1890, John Henderson endowed what we call the Henderson Family Dinner. And it's since grown into the Henderson Family Weekend. But an endowed way for keeping the family together where you get to know the stories and the values of the family. If you don't do that, I think the family just dissipates. The Frank Perdue copied this, and he left an endowment entrusted by me to have vacations continue year after year, even though he's been gone for 13 years. I mean, basically, it's in perpetuity. The family does get together and learns what we're about and what makes us who we are.
Very interesting. So normally when we think of family, we just think of the mother and father teaching their children these types of values. It sounds like this is more of a takes a village mentality. Is that correct?
Yeah, but it's more than that. You know, other things that we do, like both families, and this is something that I'd recommend to our listeners, both families have what we call a Service to the Family Award. And each year, the family member who's done the most for the family gets a very public recognition. It's a prize and people compete for it, people nominate people for it. And I love that idea because it reminds me of President Kennedy, 50 or 60 years ago, saying, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Well, this is the same kind of mentality of getting people to think what they can do for the family rather than just taking the advantages of the family. And then there's another thing that I think is really crucial and not well known enough, and that is we put a lot of effort into solving problems within the family. In both families, it's a rule that if you've got a problem, if something's irritating you and driving you nuts, bring it out. Talk about it. Deal with it. Fight about it if you have to. But the biggest part of all of this is you don't take it outside the family. We have what we call a covenant culture in which you can express things as fiercely and outrageously as you feel you need to, but you never wash your dirty linen in public. And by that I mean you don't go to the press, you don't go to, well, lawyers, because the families that blow apart, by the time a conflict is escalated to the point where you're bringing in the press or lawyers, that's almost a bridge too far. I was talking with a guy, he's a family consultant who has talked, his name is Mendoza, with the Family Business Consulting Group. And he told me that he's had 2,500 clients and he doesn't know of a single one which, once they've gone either to the press or to lawyers, has ever been able to pull back from the conflict. By the time you do that, it's a bridge too far. You're highly unlikely ever to be able to put it back together again. And so in both my families, we insist that you deal with the problems. It's against the rule to do what we call gunny sack, or, you know, store up the anger. Get it out on the table, deal with it. Again, as ferociously as you need to, but you don't take it public. You don't go to the lawyers.
Gotcha.
And compromise is key, and you're part of something bigger than yourself.
Yeah, one of the most heartbreaking things I have to witness as a financial planner is watching families get torn apart because of the wealth.
Well, then allow me to jump in and say that, again, this is a question of culture. Are the children taught just from the youngest ages that relationships are more important than money, that they owe a responsibility not just to their family, although that's huge, but the family business has to do well? Because if not, then the employees are going to be harmed. The tax base of the community is going to be harmed. The lenders are going to be harmed. And the stockholders are going to be harmed. And I can remember from childhood, I mean, maybe I was 5 or 6 when I first heard this concept. It was immoral on the scale of murder being immoral to take a family quarrel public. That it was simply required that we solve our problems within the family. And this was actually put to a great big huge test in my birth family, the Sheraton family. When my father died, there were, you know, a dozen very, very good reasons why it would make sense for a hotel company to sell to a larger company. But about half the family was fine with this and thought, economic necessity, realism, got to do it. And the other half of the family, of which I was part of the half that didn't want it, we felt that if we sold the company, that it would be betraying our father who had put all this effort into building the company. We felt nobody would care as much about the employees as we ever did. And then there was a very powerful issue, which was our identity. We had all grown up with the idea that we were part of the Sheraton family, and to sell it seemed terrible. So the arguments that went on over this were just white hot, churning cauldrons of anger and identity. But we followed what we had been taught from childhood, which is you compromise, you can't always be right, the relationships are more important than money. And we did come to a decision. We closed ranks once the decision was made. And another one of the family rules is it's against the rules to hold a grudge. So we did get past this. Nobody ever went to lawyers. Nobody ever went to the press, even though we felt as strongly as people could possibly feel. But we kept to our culture, which is we don't wash our dirty linen in public.
So Missy, in those situations where big family decisions are being made, is that done based on a democracy or is there a patriarch that kind of has the final say?
It depends on the stage at which the family is. In this case, the patriarch had just died. So what would have been his decision wasn't his decision, it was the siblings. And so I guess it was closer to a democracy. But on the other hand, my older brother, he was 17 years older than me. He had a lot of clout in the family because he had a lot of business experience and a lot of knowledge, and he was a Harvard Business School graduate. So, you know, even though emotionally we were all leaning one way, we did recognize that he had expertise that we lacked. So in the end, his decision was, or we in the end aligned with him.
So it sounds like in the Sheraton family, culture was really big. Several values there. Sounds like you were taught from a very young age. When you transitioned into the Purdue family, what was that transition like, going to a new family with maybe different philosophies or different views?
Oh, I felt, oh golly, this is a little presumptuous of me to say, but I felt that I could really contribute something to my new family from the experience with my family of origin, because I was aware of how much effort the Hendersons over the generations have put into developing a culture that supports keeping the family and the family together. And I instituted some things that I'm kind of proud of. Among them were a geographically dispersed family. I started newsletters where initially they were just for the adults to let them know what was going on in the company, who was getting married, who was engaged, that kind of thing. But then as I began studying about persuasion and culture, and I spend a lot of time reading every book I can get my fingers on those two subjects, that you really have to get family members at the youngest age to have it really sink in deep. And so I began writing newsletters for the younger children, telling them about family values such as that we're a frugal family. We don't believe in ostentation. We value honesty. We value the family history. And I can talk more about the newsletters if you'd like.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept I haven't heard really expressed too often. Most of the time when I hear family newsletters, I think of Christmas when everybody sends out the highlights for each of their individual families, a nice little picture. It sounds like what you were writing there was very specific, or there's motivation behind it.
The motivation behind it is, how do you instill values if people don't know about them? And if you're geographically dispersed, because we have family members in Beijing, we have family members in Maine.
Wow.
So how do you get them all on board, and especially the younger ones? And so the newsletters, they're very, very values oriented. I'll give an example of a recent newsletter. It was one on being frugal. And in this particular newsletter, the pattern for the newsletter is, for the kid newsletters, because there's adult newsletters and there are kid newsletters, but for the kid newsletters, not only is there some value, and I'm going to talk about frugality for a second, but there's also an activity that goes with it. So I send the kids every other month what I call a treasure chest, and it actually looks like a treasure chest. And inside it are gifts for the kids that involve an activity. And the one I'm going to describe, the frugality one, it's a story of how their great-grandmother, Mommy Doo, how she loved to entertain, and she had this very special recipe for biscuits that, you know, when she'd get the family together for Thanksgiving, and I show pictures of her and I tell a little about her, and then I give her recipe and how she, you know, she loved to have people enjoy her cooking. But then, at the end of making her special biscuit recipe, she'd make the recipe, she'd cook the biscuits, and then the biscuits were cooked on a piece of aluminum foil over a baking sheet. She would take the aluminum foil, scrub it off, clean it, dry it, and reuse it because she wasn't going to waste aluminum foil. And so that's an example of that we're a frugal family. You know, for generations we've been frugal. We don't waste money. The activity that went with this is to make it fun for the kids. And this, you know, this is part of persuasion, but if you want kids to love something, spend some time on it and make it an agreeable thing. I send the ingredients for Mommy Doo's biscuits. And then I send also a piece of aluminum foil that they're going to cook with and then clean. But I also send to make it really fun for them, I send them a chef's hat. I send them a chef's apron. And so that they get to do this in costumes, and they and the grown-up in their lives do this activity and talk about the value that this particular newsletter is about, being frugal.
That's an amazing story.
And we do this like every couple of months. And I did write a book on this. It's called How to Communicate Values to Your Children So They'll Love It. And that's on Amazon.
Oh, very nice.
And as a matter of fact, I better spell out Purdue, because I suppose if you're in Montana or in Tokyo or someplace, you don't know how the chicken is spelled. It's P-E-R-D-U-E. The university, which I love, is P-U-R-D-U-E. But forget that. We're into chickens. P-E-R-D-U-E.
So you come from a unique situation where before you got married to Frank, both of you guys were independently wealthy. For the clients that are in similar situations, what are some practical tips that they should follow?
Well, personally, I loved it that we were both independently wealthy, because that just put aside the whole issue of did anybody have bad motives for being interested in us? Because, good Lord, I remember when Frank died, I have a cousin who told me, do you realize that there are 50 people right now combing the obituaries, seeing that you're a rich widow and trying to get to know you? And he was right. So it is an issue if one has means and the other doesn't. Mm. But in the case of both of us, our prenup was the simplest thing in the world. I won't touch his, he won't touch mine.
Easy enough. Given that you've come from two very successful family businesses, can you provide some insight of what it takes to keep those family businesses successful?
Yeah, I've been giving a lot of thought to that, and I've come up with what I call a timeless secret of success, which is that both men put extraordinary effort into what I would call being giving, where there's a big principle in persuasion, it's reciprocity. And watching both of them, I noticed that they elicited just extraordinary loyalty. People were willing to go the extra mile for them. But I think they elicited that loyalty because they gave it in return. Sharton began in the 1930s, and this was a time when everybody in real estate was running away from hotels as fast as they could because they were all going bankrupt. Well, Sharton started then, and it started with the following scenario. Father would buy a bankrupt hotel, and the first day that he had taken ownership, he'd invite all the employees, and there might be several hundred of them, into the ballroom, and he'd stand up there on the stage addressing his new employees. And he knew, and he told me this so that I know he knew that every person there was demoralized and afraid they're going to lose their job. They're thinking, how am I going to pay my rent? Oh, how am I going to feed my children? You know, so they're all worried and they're all in turmoil. Well, he knew this. And his first words as he's looking at all his new employees was saying, every one of you is going to keep your job. And then he'd go on to say that nobody else in the world knew this hotel as well as they did, and that nobody else in the world knew each person's job as well as he or she did. And Father said, would tell them, I believe in you, and I'm going to give you the resources and the support to show everyone just how good you can be. And can you imagine what this must feel for the people in the audience? You know, they're afraid they're going to be fired, and now suddenly the big boss is standing up telling them that he believes in them. Well, Father used to say that people have a compulsion to live up to or down to your expectations of them. So it's a really good idea, and let me share this with all our listeners. Expect the best from people. Believe in them. Next. And this is almost the most important part. What happened in the next few days was the employees would begin seeing something that they never expected, which is when you take over a bankrupt hotel, imagine you're my father for a moment, the place has gone to seed. It's worn down. It's shabby. It's ragged. You have to invest some new money into it or you'll never get any guests. But he wouldn't put his money into the areas that the public would see. The first money that he ever put into any hotel he ever bought was into the employee dining rooms, the showers, the lockers, even the elevators and the staircases. He would upgrade all of those first because of his very deeply held belief that the success of the hotel and of the whole company was going to depend on how well and how committed and how loyal the employees were. Because he said, the success of the hotel will depend at every level on the employees. And if you show them that you believe in them and that you realize how important they are, the results can just be astonishing. Because I think that's almost the secret of his success. People with reciprocity, you know, he was believing in them that believe in him.
Wow. Talk about empowering your employees.
Frank did similar things.
What were some of the things that Frank did?
Well, one of them I was highly involved in. And we married 30 years ago. It was 1988. And when we had just gotten back from our honeymoon, we were walking on a beach in Watch Hill, Rhode Island. And it was fall, and we were walking along the beach carrying our sandals. And then suddenly I look up at him and I say, "Frank, I think we should entertain every single person who works for the company." And, well, this really took him aback because at that point there were 16,000 employees. And he said, "No, that's way too many." And I pretended that I didn't understand that he was saying no. And I said, "I think we should have them at 100 at a time." And again, "No, that's impossible." And then I said, "I think we should start in 6 weeks." "No, that's way too soon." But as we talked and talked and talked about it, he gradually changed from no to, you know, maybe there's something to it, until finally I like it. And the reason he liked it was he was always on the lookout for ways of showing the associates, employees in Purdue speak, he was always on the lookout for showing the people who worked with him how important they were. And having people in his home entertained by him was a way of showing that they're important. And 6 weeks later, we began what continued for the rest of his life. 3 times a month, we had 100 people a week, and they'd be in groups like the secretaries or the truckers or the veterinarians, basically everybody. And at these parties, what Frank would do would be, you know, here we have 100 people in our living room, and would have a buffet. And the buffet, by the way, was catered by the local chicken plant. So guess what? We serve chicken. But as these people, his employees, were going through the buffet line, he's standing behind the buffet line serving his employees. And I'm thinking as I watch this, how many heads of Fortune 500 size companies would the head of the company serve the employees? And then at the end of the evening, he'd stand up in front of his guests, who were also his employees, and he'd give them inside information about what was going on in the company. And inside information, I think, does a lot to cement the relationship between the associates and the owner, because he'd tell them, you know, frankly, the problems that we're up against, and then the fabulous opportunities that were there. And then at the very end of the evening, he'd tell everybody there that, and he had a huge, almost magnetic connection with his audiences. He'd tell them, "I know this company wouldn't be what it is today without each of you. Thank you." And what must it mean to those associates to have the head of the company entertaining them in his home and thanking them? And as a matter of fact, I even got a clue how important it was, because another thing that we did while Frank was alive and that I continued to do after his passing 13 years ago, I attended funerals where people, the next of kin, would tell me that the most meaningful thing in the deceased's life was being entertained at Frank Purdue's home. So it did have a huge impact. Frank liked a quote. Let's see if I can get it right. It was from the great psychiatrist William James from 100 years ago. And he said, "The deepest principle of human nature is the craving for appreciation." And Frank used to deliver that, you know, in many ways, but one of the ways was these parties that we gave week after week, year, month after month, year after year.
Wow, that's wonderful. Mitzi, I understand that you have 2 sons. You had mentioned the newsletters for the family as a whole. What are some things you've done specifically for them to teach them about your family values and culture?
Let's see. I didn't treat them differently. I wanted them to be totally part of the Purdue family. And that's worked, because my son Carlos was chosen 2 years after Frank Purdue's death by his stepbrother Jim Purdue to be vice president for international for the company. And I'm thinking, you know, among the things that I'm really proud of in life was that my kids integrated so well into their new family that a stepbrother appoints a stepbrother vice president. And it wasn't Frank Purdue's doing, it was Jim Purdue who did it. And the other son, again, on the integration with the family, last year, I'd mentioned the Service to the Family Award.
Yeah.
Last year, my other son, who's a geneticist and an inventor. He was awarded the Service to the Family Award for things that he did for the Purdue family.
Wonderful. That's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Mitzi, for taking the time today to share some very unique insight and helping us understand what it takes to be successful. It sounds like it doesn't come without being very intentional in what you're doing and without a tremendous amount of communication and hard work. Are there any other tips or things that you would like to suggest to our listeners today?
Well, personally, I'd love it if you'd come visit my website. It's mitzipurdue.com. I've got all sorts of things that you can get for free.
And then I understand, Mitzi, you're on the public speaking circuit nowadays. So if someone wants to see you speak in public or wants to hire you for public speaking, how would they do so?
Well, again, go to my website, mitzipurdue.com. And I would actually love to publish where I'm speaking because I've got 29 speaking engagements in the next year. But the security people at Purdue told me I can't do that because it's a security risk if somebody with a famous last name, if bad guys know where you're going to be. So I can't publish that. But I'd love to be invited to do public speaking.
Wonderful. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on today, Mitzi, and we look forward to having you on again soon.
I'd like nothing better. And by the way, I'm a fan. I've subscribed for probably, 7 or 8 years.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. Small world.
Very small world.
It is. Again, thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.